many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom?
Okay, and are you ready for the show?
Yay, we're ready, Lucy. Please start.
And so I started.
Hey, it's Kevin Nealon, and you're listening to the Homing Broadcast.
Yeah.
Personnel, this is CBTS. Space vehicle pre-count operations will start on my mark at 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Homemade Broadcast, HMB Radio on Radio St. Pete, Sunday, 6:15 p.m., Mondays, 10:15 p.m. If you missed that, catch the replay, and of course, always on podcasts at hmbradio.com. Search for hashtag HMB Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts to get this here program and others from other people in the Tampa Bay area, including James Bailey's My Mom's Favorite Podcast, the Dallas Cowboys podcast, and more coming soon. So subscribe, rate, all that for me. I would certainly appreciate it. My name is Will Koontz, host of this here show. As always, the Homemade Broadcast. I hope you're well. I'm good. And I'm not going to spare any delay this week because I am very excited to talk to this guy. He's been on the Joe Rogan podcast many times. He is the author of Renegade History of the United States, which I'm about halfway through right now. I plan on getting through it, but I'm dumb. So it takes me a long time to read things. So without further ado, here is Thaddeus Russell.
I am quite well, actually. Thanks a lot.
You feeling better?
I'm getting there, yeah.
Yeah, it's that time of year, I guess, where everybody's just sick. I got sick over I was sick Thanksgiving and Christmas this year, which was awesome because I could just sit in bed and talk to anybody.
Yeah, there is something kind of liberating about it. You know, you get to be free from work and responsibility and obligation for a little while.
There's always a lot of expectations. I don't know why I get excited about the holidays because they're always terrible. And I'm a single guy, so it's not like I have anybody to spend it with. But I just pictured in my head, like, I'm going to go walk downtown. I'm going to get a hot cocoa, even though it's St. Petersburg and it's 75 degrees outside. I'm going to go see the Christmas tree and then weep on my way home. I don't know why. I always think it's going to be great, but it's always terrible.
Yeah, this is my first flu in 20 years.
Good for you. Did you get a flu shot?
No, of course not.
I was afraid of them, and I asked my doctor this year. I said, should I get one of these? I'm 31, so I didn't know if that was too young. And he was like, I don't know. I was like, what do you mean you don't know? He's like, if you want, it's up to you. They say they're 80% affected this year. But I remember I got one when I voted, like, for the first time or second time, and they gave them away for free, and I was a little naive, and I was just like, oh, sounds good to me. I went ahead and got one.
That's what I keep hearing. Yeah, I guess I'll try it next year. But it worked pretty well for me for a couple decades, not getting sick.
Right.
We'll
right.
see.
Yeah.
You had a good run. You were due.
Exactly.
Just get it out. Exactly. Get it out of the way, and hopefully you can go for a longer stretch next time. Go for 21.
There you go.
Yeah.
So I heard about you on the Joe Rogan podcast, and I picked up your book. And I'm about halfway through it now. I was hoping to finish before you got here, but I am a slow reader. Enjoying it very much so far. It's things that you don't hear about in school. I've never heard about these things in school. I'm college educated. and never in a million years heard anything like this. So how did you, what was your path to you to write a book like that?
A long one. I went to graduate school in history at Columbia University a long, long time ago, and was a standard, what's called sort of social historian or new social historian, very left-wing. And, I mean, everyone there was that. There really was no divergence from the party line in any way, and the historical profession generally looked like that. You know, and this was in the 90s, so, this was the new social history or the new way of looking at history had pretty much replaced the old, so-called old history or old great man history. So the presidents and senators and generals and inventors who were in the center of the narrative in American history for, you know, about a century have been replaced by sort of this new crop of heroes. From the social movements, from the labor movement, from radical movements, from the civil rights movement, feminism, et cetera. They had been put into the center of the narrative. And I came up thinking that I would just continue that and continue to write about these new heroes, people like Martin Luther King and Eugene Debs, who was the head of the Socialist Party, and the great suffragists, et cetera. And I found that there was something missing, or there was a lot missing, in particular, the ways in which ordinary people generally live. And I also found that these new heroes in American history did not look like ordinary people at all. They were extraordinary. And I also found that they were actually quite similar to the old heroes, that if you look at the kind of cultural norms, the social norms followed by Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, and Martin Luther King, and Susan B. Anthony, and Eugene Debs, they're all basically puritanical. That they all sort of believe in the Protestant work ethic. They never talk about sex. They are hostile to popular culture. They are hostile to the ways in which most people lead their lives, the entertainment that were popular among ordinary Americans. Across the board, every single one of them has shared those values. And so that just, I'm interested in things that are fun. I'm interested in sex. I'm interested in drinking. I'm interested in, you know, what I'm interested in TV. I'm interested in what, you know, most Americans spend their leisure time doing. And these people weren't. In fact, they were sort of antagonistic to them. So that's where I started. And so I just started looking sort of way below in American history. I started looking below these new heroes as well. And I found that, first of all, Americans for hundreds of years have been pursuing these things that the people in our textbooks didn't like. And then more importantly, I found that by doing so, by breaking social norms, they expanded freedom, or they opened up freedom for the rest of us. So a lot of what we take for granted now in the United States, in the way we live our lives every day, was prohibited either legally or culturally until the people I call renegades came along and simply decided that they were going to live differently and they were going to break these rules. And so all these taboos were sort of eroded because of that over a period of time, and we're the beneficiaries of it. So that's the basic story.
Yeah, that is pretty fascinating. Do you think that's a kind of a normal trend for kind of the heroes of culture throughout not just American history, but maybe even other cultures? Because you don't really see, I can't really think of anyone throughout history that was open up, that would be considered, a kind of cultural hero pushing things forward.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you won't find any.
Yeah.
There's not a single political person, there's not a single, anybody, there's no hero in the textbook.
Well, I mean, who would you say, now is really kind of championing more than just social progress as a hero and also talking about those kind of those kind of elements of who we are as people. I mean, who would it be? Well, is it rock stars like John Lennon or something?
Yeah, I mean, it's generally people in popular culture. So the differentiation I like to make is between what I call formal culture, which is, you know, the discourse that comes from politicians and business leaders and school teachers, et cetera, right? That's what I call formal discourse, which is completely sexless, which is completely puritanical, which promotes the Protestant work ethic and the family, and is basically silent on sex. And popular culture, which is an entirely different world and within its own norms and values that are usually antagonistic to the formal culture. So that goes all the way back to the founding of the United States, or even prior to the founding of the United States. I mean, when the first white settlers got here, in fact, there was actually literally a civil war between the Puritans in Plymouth Colony and these sort of hedonists in Marymount Colony down the road. The hedonists of the Marymount Colony were interested in dancing and the Maypole, dancing around the Maypole and drinking whiskey and having parties with the Indians. And the Puritans at Plymouth found out about this and formed a militia and marched on Marymount and burned down the Maypole and imprisoned all the leaders of Marymount and kicked the Indians out. So it was kind of the beginning of that long civil war, which is still going on today.
You talked about the Puritan at the inception of America. I see similarities between that, different, but the way language is policed now. There's this big swing, this pendulum swing with the social justice warrior movement, the super PC movement. I remember, I guess, when I was in high school, there was like a PC push, but now it is so extreme, and I don't know what to do about it. Frankly, it scares me.
Yeah. One of the reasons that I had to become sort of the bad boy in academia and the historical profession is that I found that a lot of these left-wing heroes were puritanical, as I sort of mentioned before. And, you know, it was kind of the beginnings of PC. I mean, Martin Luther King, let's just take him for instance. I mean, almost no one knows that he preached against black working class culture, that he called rock and roll the devil's music. He told black people that they drank too much, that they danced too much, that they were having sex too much, that they were lazy, that they should work hard, that they should be puritanical, that they should be good family members, et cetera. And he's very similar to all the suffragists, all the great feminists. He's very similar to all the labor leaders. He's similar to all the socialist leaders in the United States. They all are puritanical in this way. And so it's not actually that shouldn't be that surprising that their ancestors, their heirs on college campuses and elsewhere speak the same language. It's actually the Puritanism has a long, long tradition on the American left. This is not a new thing. There have been a handful of leftists over the last 100 or so years who were anti-puritanical, but they're few and far between, and they're not actually representative of the left generally. So, where is it going to go? I mean, I don't think they're going to stop people from listening to Miley Cyrus. I don't think they're going to stop people from listening to hip hop. I don't think they're going to stop people from going to movies that have upsetting words in them, you know. The popular culture is thankfully, you know, far more powerful than any professor or undergraduate will ever be.
But it's not so much that. I guess it's more, I was pulling up something that this guy, writer Ben Norton, I think his name is, wrote about you. Where he totally, I don't see you as a right-wing, left-wing guy at all. You're kind of just a guy, a professor who's writing about his research that he found. But since it's contradictory or he made it contradictory, which is as he seems to have done in some of these things, because they're, I guess, radical views to a certain extent or new, they're automatically taken as bigoted.
Yeah. I mean, if you're critical, again, if you're critical of the icons, you know, which I am, then they're going to, people will dismiss you. I mean, it's, you know, you can't say things about Martin Luther King in this culture. I mean, you can't be critical of Martin Luther King and not get punished for it. It just doesn't happen. You can't say the American labor movement was puritanical and not actually that interested in workers' own professed interests and not be attacked for it. I mean, it's sad. I mean, it's anti-intellectual, it's dishonest, it's unprincipled. But that's what happens, and it happens on the left and the right. I just happen to be going after a lot of left-wing targets, and so I've either been shunned or ignored or attacked occasionally by people on the left because of that.
So is this ever putting? Do you ever feel like you're kind of boxed into almost where you like have to balance yourself out? And now I need to go discuss a right-wing champion. And
well, I mean, I like to be a moving target, actually. And yeah. I hate being sort of categorized. I mean, in part because I simply don't really fit any category politically.
Yeah,
I've come out of the left. My parents were so radical socialists in Berkeley in the 1970s, 60s and 70s. That's what I grew up in. And I was one of them. You know, but I also have obviously very strong libertarian streak in me. But, you know, libertarians have kind of yelled at me and told me that I'm not a libertarian, and I don't disagree with them because I differ with them as well on certain things. So, you know, I don't know. Who cares? I mean, what does it matter which box I belong to?
Yeah, which wing you fall into does not
I mean, I'm a critic of all sides.
Yeah.
I'm a critic of the left, the right, conservative. I'm obviously not a conservative. That's the only thing people are pretty clear about. You know, and I'm a critic even of libertarianism. So that's where I prefer to be. I'm my own man.
Yeah, I find it kind of interesting that you're talking about puritanicalism on the left, because I feel like that's both, on really strongly both. Because, like, if I think of, like, the 1960s and the 70s, like you're talking about your parents, that seemed to be kind of a sexual revolution going on there that was probably more on the liberal side of things, right?
Well, yeah, well, so yes and no. Right, so I grew up in a Bay Area where you could see that most powerfully. In San Francisco in the 1960s and 70s, of course, there was the Summer of Love. There was the hippies. There was people hanging out in Golden Gate Park half naked or entirely naked and smoking pot and having sex and all that and listening to rock and roll. This is true. We refer to that sort of as the countercultural movement.
Yeah.
And then across the Bay where I was born, Berkeley, was the hard left, called the new left. And that was my parents and their milieu. And that was very, very political people who were very serious about politics and about government and about economics and about revolution and social movements and all that. And they actually looked down on the counterculture as being unserious and frivolous.
Yeah.
And so there actually was, most people are unaware of this, but there actually was a very powerful tension in the 60s between those two sides. They often get conflated together, but they shouldn't be. And the left, the hard left, was actually quite puritanical in the way they operated. And in fact, the feminist portion of the new left was always really hostile to the separate. Saw it simply as, you know, a way for hippie men to get laid.
Okay,
you know, so they saw it actually as paternalistic and misogynistic and all that. So
they essentially felt like they were just justifying being sex objects, almost, that kind of attitude towards it.
Yeah, I mean, there was something to that criticism, but I mean, they had no interest in sexual liberation. They were into the feminist movement of the time, and still very basically true, I think, was interested primarily in getting women into positions of power, economically and politically, right? And so, I mean, if you read Betty Friedan's Feminine Mystique, which is kind of the founding document of second wave feminism in the 60s and 70s, I mean, that's what it's all about. And that book is actually very hostile to women's sexuality and homosexuality and fun and leisure and all the rest of it. It says, you know, women need to be leaders of corporations and political leaders. That's the only thing that matters.
I feel like the new wave of feminism that's happened now, this extreme, I look at it as extreme anyways, but I am a white guy, so maybe it's not. It seems like the biggest benefactors of this new wave of feminism is men, because it's free love, man. It's all breasts and butts and, you know, sleep around and have a great time, and you're empowered by that.
Well, it depends on what you mean by feminism. I mean, there's, you know, a couple different brands. The feminism I was just describing is usually referred to as second wave feminism, which is Hillary Clinton's generation, right? So Hillary Clinton is the apotheosis. She's the symbol. She is what women were supposed to be or become, according to second wave feminism, right? Completely shut down culturally and sexually, et cetera, but very successful politically and economically.
The stuff that you see on Tumblr, the kill all white men, that type of stuff.
Yeah, well, right. So there have been feminist dissenters against that. Always a minority, but they've always been there, who've been called either sex positive or pro-sex feminists, who, you know, have said, hey, we absolutely believe that there should be no barriers to women doing what they want to do in the society. So they were egalitarian in that sense. But they also said one of those things is, you know, having sex on their own terms and not saying that, you know, men are terrible for viewing us sexually or wanting to have sex with us. And to say that women's sexuality is a good thing and should be
that. So I'm on board with that.
So,
yeah, sure.
So, yeah, I mean, and I can give you a list of some great feminist writers who have made that argument over the years. They've always been in the minority, but, you know, those are my heroes, and those are the people I've learned from. So what you have now is on campuses and sort of in this younger generation, I think, is this odd mix. You know, it's – first of all, I think the really clearly – anti-male, anti-sex feminists are very loud on social media. I don't think they're actually representative of most women. I think they're a pretty small minority. The people who are loudest and who you're talking about, the kill all men, et cetera, or I bathe in men's tears people. I mean, they're out there and they're very noisy, but I don't think they're representative. In fact, I think polls have shown that young women, I think a majority of young women do not identify as feminist anymore.
Yeah, I think that is true. I think I saw that poll. But the thing about it is, though, is that they're very vocal and they're getting platforms on Sarkeesian spoke at the UN. And I think she's on the Twitter board now. So there's this Twitter is now a safe space, I guess.
Yeah, but I'll guarantee you that there are more women playing video games than there are people who believe in what Anita Sarkeesian is saying.
Let's hope so.
I'm sure that
rational, reasonable people can look at those arguments and see the massive holes in those arguments without having to do any research whatsoever. Just
right. I mean, one of the most interesting things about that particular debate is, you know, it is said that the sexual objectification of women retards their progress. It keeps them from doing other things in the world, right?
Yes.
That's patently false, because you can just look at the evidence. So I would stipulate that it's true that sexual objectification of women has increased in the last 10, 20, 30 years. I don't think there's any doubt about that. In popular culture, in video games, and all the rest of it, there's simply more sexual objectification of women. That's true. What else has happened with women in the United States in the last 20 to 30 years? They have taken over entire professions for women now than men. There are far more female senators and congressmen than ever before. There are far more female CEOs of Fortune 500 companies than ever before. It is, you know, a complete revolution going on. So
do you think those two
things? It's obvious that you can have. It's obvious that sexual objectification does not slow women down or stop them from attaining other things, right? It can't.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, that's 100%. Do you think those two things are symbiotic? Because I feel like those are two different things. But that is a fascinating side by side that, you know, as women are more objectified, they are also massively more successful in our society.
And not even that, too, but that's biology. We have to be sexually attracted to you. I have a boner all the time.
Yes,
and
sorry,
I can't
ladies.
Help it. It's just in my nature. I've learned how to control it at 31 years old.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's just the way it is. That's how the human drive race continues.
I will Google at you through that burka all day.
Well, I mean, the question is, you know, whether your boner for women is the same as thinking that they are inferior to you.
Yeah,
certainly
right?
not.
I mean, that's the assumption, right? Is that any man who goes to a strip club believe? In fact, I don't know if you guys saw this, but Killer Mike, you know, Killer Mike, the rapper.
Yes, sure.
Yeah, he just last night he got into trouble for saying something about. He said, having a uterus does not qualify you for being president. He's basically saying, you know, people are making this argument that women should vote for Hillary simply because she's a woman, and he's saying that's silly. So he wasn't even, it was actually a feminist point he was making. But he got trashed for this. And then what happened was a lot of people sort of dug up this information about how Killer Mike goes to strip clubs in Atlanta. And he's true. He's a big sort of fan of strip clubs in Atlanta. To discredit him as an anti-feminist, right? And I thought, and I know Killer Mike. I was on a podcast with him recently, and he actually pushed me to talk about women in African American history. And you know, he was very interested, actually, sort of as a feminist in African American history. And he's clearly a feminist guy, but it's the assumption is if you go to a strip club, you can't be feminist. In fact, if you go to a strip club, you must think of women as inferior intellectually. This is ridiculous. I mean, that makes no sense.
Yeah.
People can be sexual and intellectual simultaneously.
Yeah, but that goes right back to what you're talking to about the puritanical culture. That, oh, this guy objectifies women, so obviously he doesn't care about them.
I've only been to a few strip clubs in my life, and it's always been a very humbling experience for me. It's not what you expect. It's not dudes hooting and hollering and throwing around money. It's usually dudes by themselves sipping a beer, and they'll gently slip a dollar and gaze at her for one moment as her butt is in his face, and then he looks back down and sips his beer again. I think it's more empowering than anything else.
Yeah, 90%
of
those dudes.
Yes, Camille Paglia makes a similar argument. She's sort of an iconoclastic feminist. But sort of an anti-feminist simultaneously. She has argued about strip clubs that they're like cathedrals or churches where, you know, the woman is this iconic presence, this revered being that men worship to. They worship to the strippers. And in fact, so the power relationship is completely the opposite of what feminists think it is. That the woman in that situation has all the power, and the men are supplicants, worshiping at her feet. And I think that's actually true.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I've known several women who have been strippers, and every single one of them talks about it that way. They get paid a huge amount of money for very little work, and they are worshipped, and they love it.
Yeah, you don't see people.
And they're all. And by the way, all the women I've known who've done that have been intellectuals. You know, like these are college-educated women, political activists. I mean, who have done it, and they've all said that about it. In fact, and that's true for sex workers that I've known too. People who are called prostitutes, who sell sex. I've known several who are all intellectuals. They get paid a ton of money, and they are in control of the situation and the control of their bodies and control of their lives. And they're making money from men. And so they feel like it is empowering, absolutely.
That's part of the reason I don't go anymore, because I don't like the fact of giving a girl money to come talk to me. I find it degrading to me.
It is degrading. It is a little bit degrading.
Exactly. Right.
That's why most of the men there are there, though. They're mostly guys who cannot talk to women. If you've ever been in a strip club, 90% of those guys are not doing well with the ladies.
Yeah. I mean, so where is the oppression in that, right?
That almost seems to be like a slanderous part coming from the wing of feminists who just aren't comfortable with maybe their sexuality. And they sort of envy those women secretly. That's kind of what I feel when I hear those kind of arguments against that.
I don't know. I mean, I don't want to speculate about people's inner motivations, but that, I would say that's certainly possible.
Yeah.
Thaddeus Russell is joining us on the phone. He's the author of Renegade History of the United States. And I want to talk about this before we let you go, too. You are, I guess, the dean of Renegade University. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, so I have been a professor at five different colleges and universities, and in New York City, in Los Angeles. I've taught at Columbia University, Barnard College, the New School in New York City, Occidental College, and now Willamette University in Oregon. And I've always been frustrated by academia and feeling like there's very, very narrow range of discourse that's allowed in colleges and universities, that it's pretty much been dominated by left liberal people who are very, very intelligent and I've learned a lot from, but there's almost no dissent. There's almost no difference of opinion. There's very little intellectual diversity on colleges and campuses. There's an obsession with the diversity of color. Everyone wants to get brown and black people on the student body and on the faculty, but no one is interested in a difference of ideas. And so consequently, I've had a hard time getting established as a tenured professor. And so what I decided to do was to establish my own. Now it's possible to make your own way, to make your own university. So that's what I'm doing. I'm founding a Renegade University this summer, and it will be a mix of online courses, lectures that you can download, interactive seminars with me and other students online, and then also in-person seminars. Right now, I have enough interest to have seminars in seven different cities, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, Chicago, and New York, and Austin. And that's going to start as well this summer. So it'll be a mix of American history through my particular lens and political philosophy. I used to teach history of political philosophy at Columbia, so I'm very excited to do that as well. And we will have an open, freewheeling, liberated discussion about all these topics.
That's interesting, the cities that you named. They're all very liberal cities. And for trash, you know, the salon people trashing you and them being lefty cities, that's where you're at.
This is true. I mean, that's kind of my world. Yeah, it's sort of interesting. I mean, maybe it's, I think it's people who live in, I'm sure a lot of it is people who live in those areas who feel frustrated. And a lot of them, you know, are not, like me, they're not sort of anti-left per se. It's just that they're frustrated by what the left has become. The left has become quite anti-intellectual and puritanical. And, you know, it's time to start thinking differently about things. So that's what a Renegade University offers. A safe space to talk about that.
Yeah. Safe space.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it? Is there any kind of cost involved? Or?
Yeah, it'll be, don't know exactly, but it'll be, I can guarantee that it'll be a tiny fraction of college tuition.
Okay.
and you can sort of pay as you go. You can pay per course or per lecture, but it's going to be nowhere near what a college costs.
Any chance that Will and I can get a full scholarship?
There will be scholarships, actually, but we'll see. We'll see about the actual rules for them. You can apply.
We will.
We will definitely apply.
Professor Russell, I want to ask you about one thing that I'm struggling with, is trying to be informed as much as I can and trying to be fair. I try to read both sides of arguments. So when I read your work, for example, and then I can go online and find people trashing you, how it's complete nonsense what Thaddeus Russell is saying. How do I find the truth in this? Because they have, you know, links too. They cite their sources as well. And it seems like it's like that with anything. It's a great thing, the internet. And it's so, it's changed things for humanity. But it's also mucked up the waters.
Well, read my book. You know, I mean, I have all my sources cited in the book. And in fact, most of them are Googleable. I mean, it's easy to check every single one of my sources immediately on your computer. So it's very transparent. You can do that. And then you can, if you want to read my critics, although I don't really have that many critics. You mentioned one.
yeah,
who is not a historian.
That's fair. Yeah,
by the way, he didn't read the book. He just sat and sat criticism was based entirely on a talk I gave. Mm-hmm. But you can, you know, read him. You can read whoever you want and judge for yourself. I mean, there's nothing else I can say about that. You know, the sources are there. Now, thanks to the Internet, almost all of them are online. So you can go and judge. You can go and find the Martin Luther King speech I mentioned in which he criticizes black people. You know, it's right there online. Anybody can read it. And tell me who you think is telling the truth.
So I guess in the end, you have to kind of get as informed as you can, hear both sides, and then make a gut decision about who's telling the truth.
Don't you think? What else is there to do? I mean, there is no. First of all, I don't believe there is such a thing as truth, the truth. I mean, I'm giving you my perspective. I don't think it's the absolute truth. I do think it has tremendous amount of evidence to support it. But, you know, and I employ as much evidence as I can. I think there's a tremendous amount in the book you'll see to support it. But that doesn't mean that's the end of the story. I mean, there's more to say about it. You know, the question is whether it's a reasonable interpretation of American history. And the only way to do that is, as I said, to read the book, read the argument, check the evidence, check the sources, and read the critics if you want, and then make your own judgment.
Sounds fair.
Good.
I don't know. It's just I've been fighting, and I ask everybody I meet. I asked a news reporter that I had in here who was a veteran here in the Tampa Bay area for 25 years, 30 years. He just retired, and he had no answer for me either. It's just frustrating. It seems like I'm stuck wherever I go.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot to sort through, but I think it's pretty easy to read these things and get a good sense of it. And for some people, I mean, some people love the confirmation bias. So if they're reading something that's already reinforcing what they're into, they're going to go with that. But for the people that want to see the clearer, more rational view of things, you're probably going to be able to sort through those things.
Well, then you get accused of being something you're not. If you dissent from a certain ideology that people have. I fight with my stepfather constantly, and I don't fight with him anymore because there's no argument. It's just he's right, and I'd rather not bother. And it seems like that's happening a lot too with people on social media or Facebook. People are very comfortable spouting out pretty private things. Not that politics should be private, but really negative stuff about people they don't like. And I feel like you're only going to alienate your friend group.
Yeah, the thing that I've come to value more than anything else is intellectualism. I changed my mind over the years many times. And I really value people who do that and who simply are interested in ideas. And I especially value people who are interested in opposing ideas and really evaluating them. It doesn't mean you have to accept every idea that you hear or you have to change your mind whenever you hear a new idea, but just be open to it and think through it. Think all the way through the new challenging idea, the one that you disagree with. Think all the way through it. When I was a freshman socialist in college, I used to read the National Review. I used to read William F. Buckley's editorials in the National Review because I thought he did it the best. I thought he was a conservative who presented the conservative argument as well as anyone. And so I learned and I studied them line by line. I studied how he wrote, how he put together the argument, the ins and outs of it. I thought all the way through it. And I learned a lot, you know, from him, even though I disagreed with him on most things. You know, it was a valuable thing, and it sort of, I think it did make me into a much better intellectual, and perhaps I already was a good intellectual because of that. So I, you know, that's what I like. That's what I want in my students. That's what I want in people I talk to. What's the point of having a conversation with someone who will hear an idea and simply characterize who you are, right, or characterize your argument as basically being evil and shut it down? What's the point? There's no point in talking to those people. So don't. Avoid those people and seek out real intellectuals.
Yeah, it would be nice if our culture had more value for the idea of challenging your own ideas and be willing to change those ideas. But everybody seems to kind of want to pick their set of ideas and box them up right out the gate and just stick with it.
Yeah, and the thing about, like, when people talk about politicians flip-flopping and how it's a negative thing, I don't really view it as when they show somebody from 20 years ago say something and now they feel differently, they've changed their mind, and they're demonized for that. I think that's a good thing. You have more information, and you're smarter now, and you've got the information and changed your mind.
Well, there's the Clinton version of that, which is they changed their minds to get elected.
Yeah.
I'm not super fond of that.
But, no, definitely
people who change their minds, and there's lots of examples of this. People, you know, like pundits and politicians and activists who have actually changed their minds about key questions simply because they thought through them and just came to a different conclusion. So, you know, that's what I value for sure. Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Yeah, it's disingenuous when you know somebody's focus group has told Hillary to feel differently about something.
Just look at her history on gay marriage. It's quite hilarious.
Yeah.
I mean, she was anti, and then now she's all for it. And did you change your mind? Was this just you sat down with all the facts one day and examined all the evidence, and then you changed? No, of course not.
Yeah.
It's that gay marriage became very popular.
Right. And not only her, but our current president, same thing. He was against it when he was running, I think in the Senate. So it was at 2006, 2004?
Yeah, no, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
His Obama switched too. Yeah. He was for civil unions, but not for marriage.
Right. Not for good intellectual reasons. I can guarantee you that.
Yeah.
Thaddeus Russell, author of The Renegade History of the United States and the new dean of the Renegade University. Give out your social media website where people can find you.
My website is ThaddeusRussell.com. You can find everything there. And then I'm also on Twitter and on Facebook.
Just Thaddeus Russell?
Yes, in both cases. Yep.
All right, there you go. Thaddeus Russell, thank you so much for calling in. It was a pleasure to speak to you. One of the dissenters from the norm a little bit that you see in academia, and he's one of the good ones, and I was happy to speak to him. And that was also Jander Gray that was joining me in that interview. You can find him at Jander Gray on Twitter, and he hosts the World Domination Through Compromise podcast, available. I don't know if Jander has a website. I should probably ask him that. But just search Jander Gray on Twitter, and you'll be able to find links to his podcast and all that. Thank you to Slybar for being sponsor of the Homemade Broadcast here. Maybe you want to become a sponsor of the Homemade Broadcast. I encourage you to do so. Email me, thehomemadebroadcast@radiosaintpete.com. Leave a message for the show, 813-693-2124. Like the Facebook page, facebook.com/HMBRadio. You can find me on Twitter at @home_made_man, Instagram, same thing, Snapchat, The Homemade Man. I guess that's it. I don't know. Come out to the open mics, why don't you, at Slybar every second and fourth Tuesday of the month. Slybar is located at 2061 Central Avenue, brand new kitchen. They got food now. There's so much happening at Sly. Go check them out, slybar.com. is their website. What else I got to tell you? I don't know. I guess that's it. You want to just get out of here, I guess? That sounds good to me. All right, we'll talk to you all next week. Thank you for joining me. Have a good one.
Thank you.